Hello, I'm Martha Piskuskas. I'm a co-director here at Waterfall Arts. And it's really great to see you all here. I don't know if you've had a chance to step into the gallery. Our theme for exhibition this year is art and science, and this show is a really great example of that. So, Nick Recker jumped, right?
Yep.
He jumped.
That's me.
I won. So Nick will tell you more about the kind of, obviously, the kind of work that you do. But we're excited to have this kind of cross-pollination of art and science, and with any of our exhibitions, we try to sort of broaden how it's connected to everyone's life. So this is super exciting. I will hand it over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Martha, for that introduction. And thanks, everyone, for coming. I heard that there's, every Thursday night, there's a big music show, outdoor music show. I almost thought about skipping my own talk, so I really appreciate that you came. And also, what an amazing space that this is. I wish we had something like this in Booth Bay. I've just been walking around with my jaw on the floor. The show in there is just amazing with the gourds. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely check it out. How many, just out of curiosity, who in here is an artist? Okay, good number. Who's a scientist? All right, okay. So I have a tough crowd to meet both sides of this. Normally I just talk about science. This is the first time I've actually talked with the Tiny Giants exhibit, so hopefully I can stumble through it okay. But I did grow up with art all around me. It was a huge part of my upbringing. And I'm probably only a scientist because I failed as an artist. Or I'm a failed cartoonist. I like to think of myself as a failed cartoonist. But I love art, and I'm really excited that there's this growing movement of the intersection between art and science, because it means I get to, be involved in the art world again, not just as a hobby, but kind of in a meaningful way. And we have the Tiny Giants has been really fun. I only took one of those images. The rest of are all by, people who are much more experienced at the different types of microscopy than I am. But we've also had some artists in residence at Bigelow, and, I feel like it's this sort of thing is really picking up steam, and I'm going to try to get out here again if I can to see that periodic table. Cool cartoons of the Hellenes. Anyway, so all that is to say, this is really exciting, and so normally I talk about climate change in the Gulf of Maine and ways that we adapt to it, and I'm going to talk about that, but I'm going to start off with kind of like an overview of the Tiny Giants and the ocean microbiome, which is what we study at Bigelow, and how that connects to the images, and also just why we study it and what it is. The scientists might know what the ocean microbiome is, and many of the artists might too, but many people might not. So I'm going to start with kind of introducing that idea. So this is a diagram of the ocean microbiome done by my daughter when she was four. She's only 5 now. I thought at the time we were trying to come up with a new logo for Bigelow, and how about this? They went with this nice watermark instead. Anyway, to understand what the ocean microbiome is, I think it's actually helpful to understand the human microbiome. And you might have heard about this in the news, NPR, that sort of thing. It's a pretty new and exploding area of knowledge that we have. And the way to think about it is a human being is not just an individual organism. For a long time, we've thought a human is a human. That's what it is. A dog is a dog, and so on. And with the discovery of the human microbiome, we know that's not the case. Actually, most of the cells in your body are non-human. They're bacteria. There are all kinds of different species of bacteria, something called archaea, fungi, yeast, things like that. There's myriads of viruses throughout your body, whether you're sick or not. There's actually probably 2 or 3 different species of arachnids living on your face, and they each have their own microbiomes too. And the purpose isn't to freak you out, but this perspective has just sort of changed how we view the human experience. I mean, you think about art giving us new ways to view the human experience. This is a way that science has taken a new lens on what it means to be human. And it turns out that this microbiome, this ecosystem of organisms living in and on the surface and around our bodies all the time, interacts with the human cells as well, and it affects our health, our mood, our development, our brain development. There's something that they call the gut-brain axis, I think, which is like the communication that happens between your gut microbiome and your brain development and your brain, how it responds to different changes in your body. A lot of this research is like really bleeding edge, so it's, you know, some of it's on mice and we don't know if it applies to humans, but it could have to do with human longevity, energy levels, weight loss. I mean, there's a whole kind of pseudoscience that has spun off with it as well, but in terms of the science, it's really integral to how our whole body functions, from our health to our personality to our heredity. A lot of aspects of heredity may be tied to the microbiome as well. So anyway, that's the human microbiome, and it's you know, the research on that is just exploding for largely for like medical research and that sort of thing. The ocean has a microbiome too. It's made up a lot of the similar things, bacteria, archaea, a lot of the things that are in those images, the tiny giants images, and it's really important to how the ocean functions and things like the health of the ocean. And so I'll go through a few examples showing some of the images, some more images that, you know, wouldn't quite make the cut of the tiny giants, but they show some interesting things, I think. But aesthetically, they're maybe not quite as beautiful. And just to give you an idea of how the ocean microbiome works. So this is an image that's part of tiny giants. These are three diatoms. It's a single-celled phytoplankton, which is the plant. Most of the plant life in the ocean are these tiny single cells. The reason it looks kind of metallic is partly because it's an electron scanning microscope image, which usually coats the cell before it images it with electrons, but also because the outer casing of these cells is made of glass. The organisms pull silicate out of the water around them to build these glass shells that they live in. And the reason I put oxygen production at the top is because the ocean microbiome, cells like these that photosynthesize, just like land plants photosynthesize, they're producing oxygen. And in fact, they produce half of the oxygen that we breathe in this sort of the global atmosphere comes from the ocean microbiome. And to put that into some perspective, one thing I think is really interesting about the way these microbes and single-celled organisms produce oxygen, if you were to go back in time a little over 2 billion years on the Earth, there's life here, but the atmosphere would be poisonous to us, basically because there's not enough oxygen. The reason we have levels of oxygen and then all this oxygen utilizing life on the planet is because microbes started photosynthesizing and producing oxygen as a byproduct, and there's this big oxygen explosion, not literally an explosion, but a geological time scale's an explosion of oxygen, and that led to the evolution of the, you know, what we call higher forms of life. So they play this critical role in sort of the regulating the ecosystem in terms of the air we breathe and that sort of thing, and all kinds of other functions like that. Clean drinking water is another example. They regulate climate. This is the one image I took. I think it's kind of like the worst one of all of them, but nobody else looks at gelatinous organisms, which is what this is. This is called a cell. And the reason I have climate regulation up there, so you've probably heard about climate change and extra carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, largely carbon-based, going into the atmosphere, heating the climate.
When you say a word like the name of this guy that many of us may not be familiar with, could you say it a little slower, or maybe even spell it?
Sure, SALP. S-A-L-P.
Oh, okay.
It's like, if you try to type it, your spell check will write slap. I just saw a bunch of slaps washing up on the shore. I have this whole citizen science reporting network to look for jellyfish on the shore. So by the way, if you see any jellyfish, this is technically not a jellyfish, but people will see gobs of them and think it is, and in some ways it acts similar to them. And so people will email me, like, I just saw a bunch of slaps. I think they might be slaps. But anyway, if you see jellyfish, you can email me at jellyfish@bigelow.org, and I use like a citizen reporting network to track jellyfish blooms in Maine. But that's an aside. So the reason that they're important for climate regulation is because all this extra carbon that we put into the atmosphere, the main way that can be taken out is through the ocean microbiome. all of the single cells that are taking up carbon dioxide to, you know, sort of their version of breathing in a way, to build the structure of their cells and so on, they can pull that carbon dioxide out into the ocean. And if it's going to be removed for a long period of time, it needs to be sort of gobbled up by one of these guys, and they're sort of like vacuum cleaners. They bloom really quickly, they scoop up all of the you can think of the ocean microbiome, they package it into dense deco pellets that sink to the bottom of the ocean. So you can think of it, it's called the ocean carbon pump. It's a way, one possible way of counteracting all of the excess carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere. Nature, in to some degree, can compensate for that through these natural climate regulation mechanisms. So there's almost like this natural homeostasis that exists within the global ecosystem, largely mediated through the ocean microbiome. Another neat example, this is not one of the tiny giants images, but I just wanted to include this because I think ocean viruses are really cool. What you're looking at is a cell, and inside the cell are all these little tiny dots. This is magnified a whole bunch of times. These are, you know, it's really hard to get an image of marine viruses, but there's something like, I'm probably going to get this number wrong now. I just looked it up today to make sure I got it right. I think it's 10 million viruses in a drop of seawater. So if you've ever gone swimming in the ocean, well, who's ever gone swimming in the ocean? That's who hasn't. Because if you haven't, what are you doing here? Anyway, if you've ever gone swimming in the ocean, you've swallowed, you know, millions upon billions of virus particles. And of course, they're not, you know, we're all still here. They're not harmful to humans, but they play this this really complex and nuanced role in the ocean microbiome. So you think about all that carbon coming into the food web through photosynthesis and through this microbiome. Viruses can, you know, they can cause population crashes. They can affect how much of that carbon sinks versus how much gets redirected into things like fish and whales and the other charismatic animals that we, you know, we often think about when we imagine the ocean. So it sets up a really complex food web, and I also just, you know, think the idea of swimming in a sea of viruses is pretty amazing. And this is, you know, this is another pretty new area of research. 20 years ago, we didn't know, you know, the extent to the prevalence of marine viruses throughout the ocean and their importance. Okay, so that was climate regulation. There's also an important role for the ocean microbiome in terms of ocean health. And I put health in quotations because there's kind of a human judgment that goes on there, like what is a healthy ocean? I think in some cases it's the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy ocean, it can be clear, but in other cases it really depends on what you're interested in. So it can be kind of weighted depending on your perspective. But there are a lot of issues surrounding ocean health right now. One example, which you might have heard of, is ocean acidification. So this is kind of the other CO2 problem that people talk about. A lot of that extra carbon that goes into the atmosphere, absorbed into the ocean, makes the seawater more acidic. And it's enough so that it affects shell-forming organisms, like these microscopic snails that you're looking at here. And it makes it basically so that they can't form their shells. The shells dissolve, or that it takes them a lot more resources in some cases to build the shells. So the ocean microbiome sort of, in some ways, is an indicator of ocean health. Some of the other issues that are out there so this is another image. I don't remember what species this is, but this is in tiny giants too. And if you track down the image, you can use those fancy iPhone things, which I don't know how they work. Another kind of way that ocean health is manifested through the microbiome is through something called eutrophication, where you have a lot of, it's usually from a lot of excess fertilizer runoff like around the lakes in Maine, it could just be from people's properties, but if you think about the Gulf of Mexico dead zone, it's from kind of the Mississippi watershed washing all the fertilizer off. What happens is that fertilizer stimulates growth, phytoplankton growth, which is then grazed down mostly by bacteria, and that depletes all the oxygen in the water. You get these, they call them dead zones, or the, you know, fancy words are anoxic or hypoxic areas where other organisms can't live. And that's basically, happens through this excess growth in the ocean microbiome. Another example is red tides, you might have heard of. And these are, again, mostly single-celled organisms in the ocean, but they have toxic effects that actually affect humans. So if they can be filtered through bivalves and affect you if you eat them. In some really bad cases, just breathing the toxins that come off of red tides can affect human health. So anyway, the ocean microbiome, really important, also really beautiful by some of these images. And there's an upside to human health as well. So I mentioned red tides, that's something that you have to watch out for, but there are ways that we can utilize the resources in the ocean microbiome to enhance human health. And so this isn't one of the tiny giants pictures either, but what this is showing is a little oyster parasite called Purkinsis, which it's a single-celled organism that affects oysters. Oyster farmers worry about it because it can wipe out the stock. But what's really neat about it is it's really closely related to the parasite that causes malaria in humans. And the advantages to this are, one, it's not dangerous to humans. It's really bad for oysters, but not to humans. And we can culture it in a lab. So there's actually a guy at Bigelow who cultures this oyster parasite to use it as a model for studying malaria and possible vaccines for malaria. And there are all kinds of other examples of medicines and pharmaceuticals that are kind of sort of hidden in this, the sort of, I think of it as like the genetic code of the ocean microbiome, but there are all these sort of unknown and untapped resources, and a lot of them could have human health benefits. So that's another sort of dimension to the reasons that we study the ocean microbiome. And then lastly, just to go back to the beauty of it, these are some drawings from Ernst Haeckel, who was a naturalist in the 1800s, who is probably the first person to make, the beauty in the ocean microbiome, they weren't calling it that at the time, but to make it kind of, to expose it to a general public, to a lay public. At the time, like, science was this very elite activity, and these images, these drawings that he did had a really wide distribution. And that legacy lives on today. And that was just the name of the collection of those drawings, art forms of nature. So that's kind of the ocean microbiome in a nutshell. I feel like I've been talking. That's what I'm here for, I guess. But I was going to shift to talking about, I need to do my little Bigelow plug. And so, like I said, Bigelow focuses on the ocean microbiome, and we're trying to understand all of those things that I just talked about. Some of the cool facilities that we have there, one of them is called the National Center for Marine Algae and Microbiota. It's basically a library. I think of it, these are my own words, but I think of it as the ocean microbiome library. We have all kinds of strains of single-cell organisms that live in the ocean that we culture. And these are used for scientific purposes. They're used to grow, aquaculture feed from, that sort of thing. They're used to do pharmaceutical research. If someone is looking for a strain of some type of organism that lives in the ocean, they can come to this library and order some, and we maintain that. I think there are about 3,000 strains that we keep. That number might have changed. Another one is the Single Cell Genomic Center. This allows us to take those individual cells and map the entire genome. And so I think of it as like cracking the genetic code of the ocean. And we can use that both to understand all of those processes that I just explained and the same sort of things that I've been talking about. Human health, ocean health, all of those things. By looking at the genetic code, it tells us what each organism could be doing, and that sort of thing. And then finally, we've just started these what are called Centers for Venture Research, where we're really focused on taking the kind of the fundamental knowledge that we're uncovering about the ocean microbiome and translating it to societal benefit. And I'll come back to that a little bit at the end when I talk about ways of adapting to climate change. So that's the ocean microbiome. I'm going to go into my Gulf of Maine talk, but maybe I should take a breath and just see if anyone has questions about the microbiome. Yeah?
Well, I don't have, about Bigelow Lab.
Yeah.
How long has that been there?
Bigelow is about 40 years old. It started in, we just had our 40th anniversary a couple of years ago. For most of that time, it was at the same site as DMR in Booth Bay, though it has been a separate entity all along. And they managed, basically the story is, the founder, whose name is Charlie Yang, who was working down at Woods Hole in Massachusetts, decided, I think it had something to do with the bureaucracy there, but he wanted to make a break and start his own lab, so he put all his equipment in a boat, and he steamed up to Booth Bay. And the state had these old buildings that they were going to shut down, and he somehow struck an agreement to have a, I think it was like $1 a year to rent these buildings. I might not have that number, maybe it was $1 a month, something like that. And that agreement stayed for 30-some-odd years. After 30 years, the buildings were really run down, and just before I started there, they raised a bunch of funds to build a new facility in East Booth Bay. So now there's this new, beautiful building, which you ought to check out if you're ever down there. And that has been there. So I've been there for 3 years, and they built that about 2 years before I started. So it's been there for about 5 years. Yeah.
In that library, does it include protozoa, or is it all green algae?
Yep, there's bacteria, phytoplankton, there are some protozoans there, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How large is the scalp that you showed us in the image?
It's about the size of your pinky fingernail, which is huge in the world of, the ocean microbiome. And that scalp will eat everything from the diatoms, which are they're the large ones. The first one I showed with the glass casing, which can be as large as sort of the head of a pin. And they'll eat the scalps will eat everything down to bacteria, which are, could be a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than that. So you think about the equivalent size scale, it would be like something on land eating everything from the size of a mouse to a horse. Which is kind of like humans, actually. Never thought about it that way, but we don't swallow them whole. The South will just vacuum them up. Yeah.
Are there different species of South, or is it just one?
There's a bunch of different species. It's not even a genus. It's sort of higher up than that.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
I can Google that.
So it goes like species would be like human, genus, so species, then genus, then family, and south is one or two steps higher than that. So there are a whole bunch of different families and genus and species of souths. And they're amazing animals. They live in these colonies. That's one individual. If you go back, what I didn't really capture well, but you can kind of see, this is why I'm kind of down on this image, is because I didn't really get this. This is a chain of clones that it's sort of birthing off. And this animal alternates generations between sexual reproduction and asexual reproduction. And so it forms these colonies of clones, and they share blood with each other, and they sort of move around by pumping, and then the alternate generations will have sexual reproduction, and then the next generation will be these clones again. Anyway, just this. Like, once you start looking under the microscope, there are all of these, like, alien life forms. And I think about it like exploring a different planet, And this is just one of many examples of just these alien kind of lifestyles that the animals live. Yeah.
So what's a generation?
How long does it last?
Yeah.
Oh, could be as fast as a day or two. These are really quickly reproducing animals. They're one of the few animals that can reproduce as quickly as phytoplankton. Which is, just this really rapid, you have eutrophication in, just a couple of days, can cover a day, that sort of thing. Yeah.
How vulnerable are these microbiota to the types of pollution that we put in the water?
It would be really hard to make a blanket statement. There's thousands and thousands of species. They all respond differently to different things. Some of them eat, there are microbes that help sort of digest the oil from spills, and that's a really active area of research, especially since the Deep Horizon spill. There's been a lot of effort in figuring out, how can microbes essentially help break down those oils. So some of the pollution, there are microbes that can live on just about anything. They live at the hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean where it's many hundreds of degrees. all the time. They're, you know, they can live in anoxic environments where there's no oxygen. You know, they can live at the bottom of the ice caps where it's been cut off from the atmosphere for, you know, eons. Within the ice, there's just all kinds of, they can live in basically any environment. And that's why, you know, when NASA goes looking for signs of life on what we think of as uninhabitable planets, they think that there's a possibility that there's life in these places, because in the most extreme environments that there are on Earth, we find microbes living. Okay, now to the Gulf of Maine. So, I'm going to talk about usually when I talk about the Gulf of Maine, I do this kind of extended history. I've kind of condensed it so I could fit the tiny giants piece in. But I'm going to start like way back before Europeans were here, and kind of move up to present day and talk about some of the changes that are happening. And I'm going to talk about some of the changes that are happening now, and then I'll end with some of the tools for adaptation, which relates to research that's happening at Bigelow and elsewhere. So when you start with ye olde Gulf of Maine, this is a map of what the Gulf of Maine looked like about 10,000 years ago, as the most recent ice age was ending. And this is a nice quote from a book by Spencer Apollonio. The Gulf of Maine, as we know it, is much younger than the beginning of recorded human history. Sorry, that's not actually a quote, that's a paraphrase. But that's basically the idea. 10,000 years ago, which is a little bit, I think, before the beginning of recorded human history, is when this image is. So what you're seeing, here's Cape Cod Bay. There's Cape Cod. Cape Cod Bay would be there. There's all this land here because a lot of the water from the ocean was contained in ice that was on land. There's the ice sheet up there. So you can see the Gulf of Maine. So here we would be, let's see if I can figure this out. One of these is Penobscot Bay. I think maybe this one. And so we would be up here somewhere. And you can see it goes way further inland, all the way up in the Bay of Fundy and so on. And the Gulf of Maine is also like mostly cut off from the ocean. So for one thing, it would have been much fresher because there's a lot of fresh water running in and not much mixing with the open ocean going on. And the tides that Maine is famous for would have been almost non-existent. The tides really rely on the geometry of the Gulf. It's almost like if you took a bucket of water and shook it back and forth at just the right frequency, you could get a really big sloshing. That's why we have big tides in the Gulf of Maine. But if you were to change the size of that bucket and try to do it at the same speed, you wouldn't have the speed right. So the Gulf of Maine looked really different. The reason I have a picture of this mastodon here is because the fishermen have pulled up mastodon tusks out here on what is now Georges Bank. So this is all ocean right now. But it was inhabited by, you know, crazy prehistoric beasts at one point in time. Eventually, the ice sheet receded. Those areas of land were covered over with water. You know, the tides would have increased gradually as that happened, and probably sometime around, like Spencer said, sometime around the time of recorded human history, the Gulf of Maine looks like what we would recognize today as the Gulf of Maine.
What are the blue dash lines? The blue lines.
So I have the paper that I got this from, and I can look this up to confirm. I think he was just trying to outline kind of like where the, you know, I don't know, ridges or edges of the ice sheet were. Yeah, I'm not sure. That's a really good question.
Which way they would melt when they...
Yeah, are they divides?
Divides between, oh, like the water flows off of one side. Yeah, that could be. That could be like a continental divide, yeah. You know, this is just the way I teach, too. When a student asks me a question and I don't know the answer, usually the students come up with a better answer than what I can come up with. But, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. They could be the ridges indicating which basin that the water was flowing into. Yeah, you guys are smarter than me. Okay, so let's fast forward to when Europeans get here. That's a big jump. These are some more anecdotes just to show that even you know, 500 years ago or less, the Gulf of Maine was a really different place than what it is today. So John Cabot comes to the New World. He described cod so thick that a person could walk across their backs. This is the, you know, cod is the main reason that Europeans came to Maine. He was talking about Newfoundland, but it was the same story here. Just this hugely abundant resource. The European fish stocks have been pretty much fished out. Just a huge amount of cod, and you know, if you've been here for a while, I'm sure you've heard that New England was founded on cod. Hunters pursued right whales from shore, sometimes in wind or hand-powered watercraft. You know, try to imagine doing that today, or just imagine what the ocean must have looked like. This is a nice quote from Nathaniel Hawthorne, who he says, "I caught a black-spotted trout. It was almost a whale." This was in Sebago Lake, but similar story happens in the ocean. 18 and a half pounds. If you look on the Fish and Wildlife website today, you'll see that the average size for the species is about a pound to a pound and an eighth. So it's not just that the species that are there are changing, they're also getting smaller. And we see this not just in this one example, but throughout the Gulf of Maine. And then this is another one of my favorites. This is actually around the turn of the 1900s. Herring gulls were hunted nearly extinction. They were used in millinery, which is shown here. They were also just hunted for their eggs, which were really easy to harvest. And they're one of the early conservation focuses for the Audubon Society. So the reason that we have all these flying rats is because, you know, they were almost wiped out, and you know, that was an early conservation effort of the Audubon Society. So in many ways, the scene, if you could go back in time to any one of these time periods, you would see a really different Gulf of Maine. Along those same lines, we have pilot whales harvested by the thousands annually on Cape Cod. These are some images from a guy named Bill Leavenworth, who presented these at this kind of big Gulf of Maine meeting, which I'm going to get back to in a few minutes. So I'm sort of paraphrasing some of his research, but they recreated what a lot of the fisheries have looked like going back in time. Diagenous fish numbered in the billions. You know, you guys have an alewife running here?
Not in Belfast.
Have you ever been down to like the one in Damariscotta or anything like that? It's just amazing to watch. We take the kids there every year. But it pales in comparison to imagining billions of fish swimming up Maine's rivers. Tuna was a bycatch of the coastal herring fishery. So think about that. There isn't much of a coastal herring fishery anymore. And you certainly don't think of tuna as bycatch. And then swordfish in Portland Harbor. Oh, I don't have that image anymore. But there's some great, Bill has some great imagery of swordfish being harvested in Portland Harbor. And I was just talking with Ron, is it? About swordfish up here, and how cool it would be if, and they were up here as well, you know, how cool it would be to see swordfish up here. You know, I lived on Pepys Island for a few years. I, you know, took that ferry to work every day, and just trying to imagine, you know, herring weirs catching, you know, loads and loads of herring and even tuna as bycatch and swordfish swimming around, and, you know, and now, you know, of course you see a lot of lobster pots, which is a good sign of some aspect of ocean health, but then you also see a lot of oil tankers and cruise ships, and I don't know, it's just a really different scene. So the point to all of this is that we often think about a past where the Gulf of Maine had this pristine, untouched state, but that's a bit of a fairy tale. The ocean, and especially the Gulf of Maine, has changed a lot, even since the times that humans started recording history, and especially since Europeans got here. We live in a changing system. It makes it really hard to say what the historical baseline is, which can make it tough for a lot of conservation efforts, or just management efforts in general, because that baseline is always changing. And I think there's not enough appreciation of that from a lot of anglers. And so for me, what this really brings up is the question of how do we live in a changing system? You know, I don't think we should be trying to, you know, restore something to a pristine state. We should be thinking about the system as already changing, and what's the best way to live in a place that's changing. This picture, by the way, is the King Tide in Portland now. You know, the tires of these cars parked on the wharfs are underwater at the highest high tides now. So That really brings home the idea of a changing system. And sea level is one of the areas we're feeling the impact the most. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about what's happening today. So I said the system is changing. It's always been changing. But that doesn't mean that the changes that are happening today aren't much, much faster than anything we've seen. And that is, in fact, what we've seen. There are ways in which systems change naturally, like the moving in and out of glacial periods. There are ways that the system has changed through fishing over centuries. But then the pace at which change is happening today, right now, is like nothing we've ever seen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what's going on now. This is a map. You can see the Gulf of Maine. I wonder if I can use this pointer. Yeah, you can see the Gulf of Maine right there. What the colors are showing you is the rate of temperature change over the past decade. So areas where it's yellow and red means a faster warming. Area where it's white means no change. And then the green and the blue, actually, there's been a cooling over the last 10 years. And you can see that the Gulf of Maine stands out like a sore thumb. We've had some of the fastest warming basically ever recorded when you look at that sort of decadal time scale. This is another way to do it. I should mention, by the way, that I was a math major, so I really like charts and graphs. I'm going to expose you to a few of those. Hopefully it won't be too geeky, but you'll definitely see my geek side come out a little bit. This is a histogram, so if you're geeky like me, you like histograms. If not, I'll explain it. This is just showing you, if you took all the sort of the whole ocean together and said, how fast has it warmed or cooled over the last 10 years, and put that all together in a bell curve. So most of the ocean is going to fall right here in the middle where there's been moderate to low warming or cooling. And I've indicated some places here. There's the Gulf of Alaska, which over the last 10 years has cooled. It needs to be updated. They've started turning around. The Gulf of Mexico is about even over the last 10 years. And then the Gulf of Maine is way out here. So at the very edge would be a 4-degree change over a 10-year period. So we're almost way out there. And so we've warmed faster than 99% of the rest of the ocean. And in fact, this holds true. If you look back, this shows the last 10 years. If you look back over the 100 years throughout the temperature record that we have of the ocean, it's basically unprecedented, this rate of warming over the past 10 years. We haven't really seen an ecosystem go through a warming like this. So it's very striking. And what this is showing you is what to expect looking in the future. So one of the tools that we have to sort of look forward are these climate models, and then do them for the ocean as well. And this just tells you kind of what to expect. I think this map is by temperature change by 2100. And again, you can see up where we are in the Gulf of Maine, that's where we're expecting the most warming. Most of the ocean is just sort of, I think that's green, I'm colorblind, so it's probably why I didn't make it as an artist. Most of the ocean is warming at this sort of green level here. A couple of areas are cooling, actually up by Greenland, and that has to do, actually that's connected to why we're warming so much faster. So we may be in for some remarkable change that could continue into the future. This, by the way, is what those models look like. I just thought this was a neat animation. So the Gulf of Maine is right here. This is showing deeper water. So the blacked out area is shallow water. And the reason it's showing that is because that's where this sort of warm water comes into the Gulf of Maine. The reason for this, by the way, there's a number of reasons. Part of it is natural fluctuations in temperature. You can get these rapid 10-year warming periods, and then things can go back down and that sort of thing. Part of it is the background warming that sort of the whole ocean is experiencing. And part of it is because the Gulf Stream, which kind of goes off the Carolinas here, it's this sort of warm water that goes off and it heads east towards Europe, is part of that. The Gulf Stream is really tied into the whole circulation of the ocean. And as things warm, this sort of overturning of the ocean looks like it's slowing down. And that tends to force, like we're kind of right at the intersection between these two currents that are really important in that circulation. That tends to force more of that warm water up into the Gulf of Maine. This is another way of looking at kind of just the temperature trend. And it's data. It's a sort of smooth temperature record going back to 1980. The black line shows you the 30-year trend. The red line shows you the last 10 years. It actually ended at 2012 up there, but if you, this is something else I need to update. But if you put in the last few years, as I'm sure you know, 2016 is kind of off the charts warm as well. It's really warm in the ocean too. And if you continue out the last few years, that steep slope continues. So, you know, we've had this really rapid warming. This year, 2012, by the way, is really, this last dot on the plot is really what woke us up to the fact that something unusual is going on. I mentioned that we had these kind of Gulf of Maine meetings. It happens once a year. It's called RARGOM, which is a sort of ugly acronym that stands for something about the Gulf of Maine. But it's a really neat sort of time when all the scientists from kind of Cape Cod around to Nova Scotia who are working on the Gulf of Maine, they all get together in this, you know, I think of it as like a high council, but that's not what it is. But just to say, like, what's happening in my part of the Gulf of Maine, and what's happening in your part. And in 2013, the year after this happened, everyone was saying, like, this, you know, we're in the middle of a heat wave. Where did my little pointer go? Anyway, that point way up there, I'll use my shadow. You know, we're in the middle of a heat wave. This is something like we've never seen before. And everyone was saying all of the unusual things that happened in 2012. And this is like fall of 2013 when we were talking about it. One of the neat slides that came out of that meeting was this one by a guy named Alan Wanamaker, who does this kind of research where he looks at really old clams and other ways that the temperature records are kept for hundreds of years, sort of like rings in a tree. You can think about it that way. You can also do it with hard corals. They keep temperature records over many, many years. And he reconstructs temperatures going back a few hundred years. And this was his temperature reconstruction for a particular location in the Gulf of Maine. And this is where 2012 was. So it was like, you know, warmer than anything we've seen in hundreds of years. And, you know, 2012 is still the warmest year we've seen, but, you know, the other years have been right up there, too. And so at that, and I want to tell a few of the stories that came out of the meeting, because it was really, this is really when the scientific community kind of woke up to how fast things were changing. You might have remembered the kind of the story about lobsters from 2012. That's the first one. I'm just going to go through these. It was so warm, and lobsters, as you probably know, have a migration from offshore to nearshore, which is timed really well with the other migration that happens in Maine from Massachusetts and places like that to coastal Maine. They seem to line up coincidentally really well, and that's really good for the lobster industry. That the migration of lobsters, at least, is triggered by temperature. And in 2012, it was so warm that migration happened about a month and a half early. All these lobsters came inshore. The industry started catching them. At the same time, the processing industry, which is mostly in Canada, was closed down for renovations because it's not the high volume time. And so there wound up being all this extra product on the docks. The prices plummeted, and it really hurt the industry. That was kind of the big, that was the one that made the newspapers across the state. On the flip side, there are these, some other fisheries that actually benefited. So that's a longfin squid, the next one, which we historically haven't really seen in the Gulf of Maine. It tends to like warmer waters. It appeared in coastal Maine in 2012, and a fishery sprung up to exploit it. There weren't any sort of restrictions or rights on the fishery already. And so people were able to go out and catch that species and find a market for it. It's not just warm species come to. We often think as the Gulf gets warmer, it's going to be these southern species that come up. That year, there were also the first sightings of bowhead whales, which are these whales here, which is an Arctic species. And normally we have right whales in the Gulf of Maine, which is kind of a cousin of this whale. But for whatever reason, maybe it was warm in the Arctic too, and this is kind of my theory, is that they were just looking around for new habitat. But there were two sightings of bowhead whales that year. One in Cape Cod Bay, and the other was up by the Bay of Fundy. Another story was the big jellyfish bloom started. That's a comb jelly, which is actually not another non-relative of jellyfish, but is similar in a lot of ways. It started in 2012. I took a group of Bowdoin students out that year to do some sampling of crustaceans. I was going to teach them all about it. You always fill your nets with crustaceans. We didn't catch a single one. All we were catching were these cone jellies. And then over the next few years, we've had these. I don't know, you've probably seen them around here, especially last year and the year before, these big outbreaks of different types of jellyfish. That has a different food web effects. The next picture is a puffin chick, this one here. Yeah, I think it's cute. Some people are horrified. I think it's like this hideous sort of thing. But I think they're really cute. I've done a bunch of work on the puffin colonies as well. And they're just amazing places. It's like this whole universe owned by the seabirds. I felt like, the first time I went, I felt like I was Dorothy landing in Munchkinland. Anyway. I literally felt like that. I could almost hear that eerie music playing. The birds just own the islands. The puffin chicks eat, they live in burrows underground. The adults, the parents, bring them fish that they catch, and they're usually these long, thin, juvenile fish that are like hake or herring or things like that. This particular year, with the cone jellies, another fish had taken the place of these butterfish, which is what you see there. It's wide and flat, and the puffin chicks can't swallow it. And so they have to swallow their food whole. And so there's this big die-off of chicks that year. So there are these other effects that were kind of reaching throughout the food web, and you know, kind of all these pieces were fitting together as people told these stories. And just a couple more, the northern shrimp, which we used to really enjoy here in Maine, that fishery has been closed since 2013. It's a cold water species, and basically it's too warm. It's no fault of managing a fishery in a certain way, but just when a species can't handle the temperatures anymore, we can't really fish it anymore. I think there are a couple of small experimental harvest on it that was open this year just to see if maybe they're coming back. If it was just this really one-off year. But you know, the long-term trajectory as we get warm is, you know, the outlook is not good for that species. And then you probably have heard of the green crabs as well. It's another warm water species. They came up once in the 50s when it was really warm, and sure enough, as it got warm in 2012, they came back. They really wreak havoc along the coastline. They sort of re-engineer the shoreline by digging for bivalves and that sort of thing. If you've been wondering why you haven't seen a lot of blue mussels where you used to see them along the shore, that's one of the main reasons. Sort of a nuisance. There actually, I just read an article about an Italian chef who has just come over here. They have a similar species there that they eat, but you have to harvest them with a really soft shell, and it takes this real expertise to know, because they're small, you know, you can't just like get a lot of meat out of them like a lobster. Anyway, so they're looking now at, can we like actually find a market for these in Maine? But anyway, a lot of change happened all at once. And to go back to cod, which, like I said, is the reason New England was settled by Europeans in the first place, to put it into perspective, the cod fishery, that same group that did some of those old fisheries images, they used old fishing logs to reconstruct, to make estimates of what the fishery was like at different periods throughout time. There was one year in the 1860s where they were able to put together a really good estimate of the catch out of two harbors, Winter Harbor and, what was the other one? I'm blanking, but like right in that same area. The catch from just those two ports in hand-powered and wind-powered vessels. You know, these are basically people catching cod with hook and line by hand. It was about 10,000 metric tons. By comparison, the quota today is about 300 for the whole Gulf of Maine. So it's a really, you know, just to put that point home, it's a really different system. But one of the main reasons that we haven't been able to manage this fishery very well is because we haven't been taking this rapid temperature change into account. So I think this is the last graph I show you. But what it's showing you is, I put here, this is from a paper that came out recently, extra mortality. So every year, the management tries to figure out how much mortality is going to be caused by the fishery, and therefore what they expect the stock to be the following year. And every year over the past 20 or 30 years, there's been this essentially extra mortality. Not every year, some years it's been negative, but the extra mortality that's not taken into account Turns out that it correlates really well with temperature. So temperature is affecting the species in a lot of different ways that has made it really difficult for us to manage. And that's one of the main reasons that this species has just continued to decline. So things are changing really fast. I think I'm going to put this, I lied about that being the last graph, I guess. But I'm going to turn all these graphs into like a cartoon version of the way I see this. This is a climate change plot. It's the sort of thing that people put in reports or sometimes news stories to describe climate change. This is just global temperature going up through the year 2000, and then you see these different scenarios. That's what people do. They say, oh, you know, if we curb our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, things could level off. There's the business as usual where things keep going up. There's so different scenarios of temperature. And I think what this puts in people's mind, or at least in my mind, is a picture that looks something like this. Here we are now. Here's the year 2100. And on the vertical axis is something we worry about. It could be global warming. It could be temperature. It could be sea level. It could be ocean acidification. It could be jellyfish. It could be all kinds of things. But we're looking at this, you know, we look at this graph. We see a smooth line that does something like that. And we're worried about this point out here in 2100 where all this bad stuff is going to happen. The way I think we should be looking at it is more like this. Because this is what really happens. We don't go up this smooth trajectory to like a warmer world or whatever. There's a lot of ups and downs along that incline. And the Gulf of Maine, in terms of temperature, is going through one of those rapid ups right now. There's going to be times where it levels off and goes back down, and then times when it goes up rapidly again. But it's really those sharp increases that can take an ecosystem and really turn it inside out. And it's the same thing if you think about storm surges, right? It's not this gradual sea level rise that's going to get us. It's when the next big hurricane comes through, or the next big, you know, the flooding in Louisiana, that sort of thing. It's these events. You know, the sea level is still, on average, rising gradually like that, but there are these big events that really affect us a lot more than others. And the Gulf of Maine just happens to be the first sort of example of a system going through something like this. And so there's a lot, I think, that we can learn from it, both that to sort of help ourselves, but also lessons that we can export to other places. You know, if you're thinking about, if you're worried about what this place is going to look like for your kids or your grandkids, you know, maybe you should look at the Gulf of Maine and think about what's happening now and what could happen down the road for you. So here's my next pause before I go into tools for adaptation. Because to me, it's not all gloom and doom. Actually, there are two sides to the climate change story, to the response to climate change. Right? One of them is mitigation. That's really important. That's just like the big agreements that they've just come to in Paris is really key to reducing the problem at its source. But to some degree, we're already locked into some of this change. Even if we, shut everything down right now, there's still going to be residual warming that comes and residual sea level rise. And so the other part of that equation is adaptation, which is what I really like to think about. I think I have to think about this optimistically in some ways because I have kids, and these things are happening now and they're affecting all of us. But it's also, it's exciting from a scientific point of view. And you can take some of this basic research, whether it's on the ocean microbiome, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, or to do with other technologies, and really help help our society to adapt to some of these changes. So maybe before I go into an adaptation, I could pause again. Catch my breath, then, if you have some questions. Yeah.
That change
It's actually really tied to April bottom temperatures. So that there's something about, so the scientists, I know a couple that are working closely on this problem. They're still trying to figure out the exact mechanism behind kind of the cue that happens there. But what they figured out is, if you go back over the last 20 or 30 years that we have data, if you look at the mid-April bottom temperatures, it's almost an exact correlation to when the lobsters arrive on shore it ranges anywhere from June through July, depending on how warm it is. Excuse me. So the answer to your question is it just depends how warm it was in April. So in years where the April temperatures have been cool, we have had a couple of those since 2012. Indeed, the lobsters showed up more at their normal time. And in other years, like I think this was a warm year in April, and I think they came in a little bit early this year, and last year as well, they were a little bit early. Nothing quite as early as 2012, but it seems to be really key to that, that April temperature signal.
So,
just
follow up, the 4 degrees of early BC warming in the last 10 years? That's a surface, that was a surface temperature.
Yeah, so that was what I was showing with surface temperature. The heat wave that came through in 2012 was surface to bottom. It was about 3 degrees C warmer than average temperatures pretty much for the whole year. You know, normally when you see these changes, it'll be like a warm summer, a warm winter, and this heat wave, they're calling it, lasted for about, actually about 18 months. And it was surface to bottom.
Looking at those several graphs where you had the gradual rise and then you had the spike for 2012, what if that were continued? Is anybody worried that that line is going to keep on going instead of the gradual line that you predicted?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what the model is saying over the kind of the long term out to 2100 is that we are going to be warming faster than the rest of the ocean. For that really steep line to continue, you know, we would really go off the charts. I don't think it's sort of physically, I shouldn't say it's not physically possible, but it's probably going to level off at some point. There were other reasons for the rapid rise in temperature. Part of it is, this is actually one of the things I cut out of my talk to reduce the time, but there are these climate oscillations in the ocean. The one that you've heard about the most is El Nino. It happens on these kind of decadal scales of warming and cooling. There are other examples throughout the ocean. There are a couple in the Atlantic. There's another one in the Pacific. And they all really affect, they can all affect Gulf of Maine temperatures, or temperatures anywhere, but in this case, the Gulf of Maine. They're not in phase with each other. So one could be high and another could be low, and they can balance out. And the Gulf of Maine might just be average in that case. And over the last 10 years, a bunch of them have kind of also come into phase to add additional warming to the Gulf of Maine. So because they have a rough cyclicity to them, we expect those to go out of phase. And so that steepness of that line will probably reduce to some degree. But some of the other effects, like the background warming and the slowdown of the kind of the ocean circulation, probably will continue to have an effect. And so we do still expect a more rapid warming in other parts of the ocean. Yeah?
So the Gulf of Maine and the whole sort of northeast corridor there, is the hottest, has gotten hotter than any other part of the ocean in the last 10 years.
The rate of change is the fastest.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The water itself is
right.
not hotter
right.
than
right.
the
okay.
drop,
the rate of change.
But the rate of change.
So, and that is, so you just answered some of my question
yeah.
what you just said, but is there some way in which it's just geography is why it's there?
Yeah, basically.
That's really the reason why that the concentration of the increase, the rapid increase.
Yeah, I mean, partly it's because there's the Gulf Stream, the warm current, and then there's the Labrador Current coming from the Arctic, and we just happen to be right around where they meet. Part of it too is that we're this kind of shallow, semi-enclosed sea with this deep channel that allows that warm water to come in. I'm not sure how well you can see that from the from the animation. So. The blacked out area is water shallower than, I don't know, let's say 50 meters. I don't know exactly what it is, but, and then the water in the middle is much deeper. So it's almost, we are still almost enclosed in a lot of ways, and then there's that one deep channel that allows some of that Atlantic water to come in.
So it's not,
the
Northeast has a lot of issues because of, you know, wind coming here and air quality, et cetera, but it's not because of
nope.
It's not human per se.
Other than the general way the warming is changing the circulation patterns, Yep, it's kind of location and our geometry. Oh, yeah.
So when you look at the world the last 15 months, globally, it's been an outstanding record. So how does that... How do you make models when that's not happening?
Well, in the ocean, so water has about 100 times the heat capacity of air, which basically means, you know, to heat the same volume of water takes about 100 times as much energy as heating the same volume of air. So when you have a really warm year in the atmosphere, it takes a while for that information to sort of propagate into the ocean. You know, when you look at the atmospheric temperatures doing this, and the ocean will kind of make this nice smooth line. So that heat does get absorbed into the ocean, but it doesn't change the ocean temperatures as rapidly. It's sort of integrated over a much longer period of time. I don't know if that exactly answers what you're asking.
It feels like false comfort.
What does?
The ocean is not going to change as quickly as the air because it takes so much more energy to warm it.
Yeah, actually, the ocean is one of the main reasons why we have a stable climate. You know, it's if we didn't have the ocean, then you know, greenhouse gases would make the Earth warm much, much faster. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, you know, we should be thankful, I guess, that it's there. But you're right. I mean,
then you know, the ice is melting faster, yeah. So you don't have that reflection.
That's right. There are other ways that heat works its way into the system. And there are a bunch of feedbacks. And so one of them, like you say, is ice. So we lose the fact that they reflect heat back off of the Earth as they melt. There are there's permafrost, which is melting, and that's actually releasing more greenhouse gases like methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. There are a whole bunch of feedbacks that once you start the system warming actually make it worse. There are a few negative feedbacks as well, but most of the feedbacks we know about are positive feedbacks that sort of make it worse.
So it seems like when this got rapid change and then human life and animal life and plant life can't adapt as quickly as the change is, then adaptation is kind of too slow to respond.
Yeah, so when I say adaptation, I don't mean it in an evolutionary sense. I mean, like, what can we do to start dealing with this? For ourselves, like, what are the tools we can use to help deal with that part of change that we're sort of locked into?
Well, one of the adaptations for us to become familiar with fish that are we presume are more southerly, but now will become standard fishes, groupers, and other warm water species that we're moving into here.
Yeah. So, for example, you know. Right now, 90-something percent of our fishery is one species. And that species, you know, there aren't really fisheries in southern New England anymore because of the water temperature. And at some point, it will be too warm, probably will be too warm in the Gulf of Maine for lobsters. Mm-hmm. Right? So diversifying and thinking about ways to exploit some of the species that are coming in would be a way for a tool for adaptation for the fisheries. There's a whole slew of regulatory issues around that I only have a very kind of loose grasp of. But for example, some of the species that come in, the rights to fish them belong to fishermen in like New Jersey, for example, because that's where the fish have historically been. So they might come in and be an abundant resource that people here can't fish. That wasn't the case for longfin squid, but it can be the case for others. So, you know, part of the tool for adaptation is just for management, for example, to start thinking about things in a changing way rather than, you know, it's almost the same way conservationists often think of going back to this pristine state. How can we restore this stock to what it used to be when it could be that it's too warm now for that species to even be in the Gulf of Maine? So I think some of these ideas are percolating throughout different communities, fishing communities, management communities, and scientific communities, and figuring out how to use that knowledge to allow us to adapt is a real challenge. I mean, it's science is involved, but also the human dimension makes it really complex. That's a great example. And, you know, there are lots and lots of examples of tools for adaptation. I'm going to show you a few here that relate to the ocean microbiome because that kind of brings it back to the theme of the artwork that's out there. But there are lots and lots of other ones, too, that I'm not mentioning. And I'd be happy to stick around and, you know, tell you what I know about those as well. So one of them, you know, going back to ocean acidification, these are like the fragile, you know, microbes. Well, they're actually snails, relatives of snails, but they're part of the microbiome. Acidification is going to be a problem as more CO2 is absorbed into the ocean and the sea becomes more acidic. Part of the solution to this problem is actually tied into some of the solutions to seafood security, which I think it's a really nice kind of connection of different solutions. So, you know, the global human population has gotten really, really large. I think it's estimated to hit something around 10 billion by the end of the century. And, you know, that we're running out of space. There are droughts. There are shortages on some of the elements that are used in fertilizers. And a lot of those problems don't exist in the ocean. Right, you're never going to run out of water in the ocean. I should not say never, because people once said we're never going to run out of cod, and they were wrong. But you know, there's plenty of water in the ocean. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of nutrients that exist naturally in the ocean. And in parts of the world where there already are billions of people, like China and India, they've figured out that if you grow kelp, you can produce food much more efficiently. This is just an aerial image. I think this is in Taiwan, actually, of just like the scale of kelp farms. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. One of the bonuses of growing kelp is that they're photosynthesizers. They take up CO2. So they actually remove carbon from the water and can counteract that acidification process. It's not, you can't really... You know, we don't know of a way to do this on a global scale enough to actually counteract the CO2 effect globally. But if you think locally, you know, in the coastal zone, where acidification really could matter to shellfish, you know, shellfish that are growing and harvested naturally, or shellfish that are grown by people for consumption, where acidification could really become a problem, we're investigating ways that you might couple that with kelp growth so that you can draw down some of that CO2. You know, keep the sort of, I think of it as the ocean microbiome in a sort of healthier state, a healthier ecosystem, and sort of counteract that acidification effect. Another example that I think of that's going on at Bigelow that I think of as a tool for adaptation is ways to do early warning systems. So I mentioned things like red tides, and oyster parasites. This is that oyster parasite again. A lot of these are microscopic and they're microbial. Some of them are really hard to detect. And so there's this company called Biomeme, which builds this device that you put your iPhone into. And it's basically a genetics tool that you can do in your home. The scientist at Bigelow who's starting to work with these does this nice talk where he does like a cheek swab at the beginning of the talk. He puts it into his iPhone, this device, and it runs, and it finishes by the time the talk is finished, and then you can see if you have a genetic predisposition to whatever the test is, I can't remember, some heart disease or something like that. So it can do all this kind of genetic, this sort of genetic tools that you used to need a big lab for are starting to get more and more portable and more accessible to everyone. And so the way I think about these being used as a tool for adaptation is, you know, imagine if every shellfish farmer had them up and down the coast, and you network them together. You could know instantly if something like a red tide or some type of parasite were coming into your area. I mean, that's been one of the big problems with climate change, and also with the increase in shipping, is invasive species and the spread of microbial species and the damage that they can sometimes do. So that's a pretty neat tool for adaptation. Because I really like viruses, I have kind of a crush on viruses. One of the tools for adaptation that people use is actually, it's almost like a vaccination of the ocean. So lots and lots of the viruses in the ocean are specialists. They only affect one other organism. So you can actually use viruses in the ocean, like if there's an undesirable microbial species, like a parasite or a red tide or something, and you can find a virus that's associated with that species. Normally what would happen in a natural cycle is the species would bloom, the virus would follow, and that would sort of end the bloom, and another species would come in. There's this sort of succession. But if you know that, if you can isolate that virus, you can move its timing earlier and sort of inoculate against a damaging species in the ocean. And they do use this method in different parts of the world, in things like aquaculture, for example. So I think that's pretty neat. And then the last one I'm going to talk about is kind of it's one of my pet projects. I was supposed to introduce this before I showed it. But anyway, this is one of my sort of sci-fi visions of the future. I grew up reading a lot of sci-fi and things like, time travel and jetpacks and, video conferences like on Star Trek and that sort of thing. And a lot of those things have actually come to pass. I don't think time travel has, but, who knows. And so I think, I like to have my own little sci-fi visions of what future technology might be like. And one of the things that I think we should have in the future are what I call ecocasts, or ecosystem forecasts. And so just like you go and turn on the TV or the internet and get your weather forecast for today, tomorrow, or next week, we have the technology where we could actually be getting ecosystem forecasts to go with that, whether it's mosquitoes or deer on the highway. You can think of all kinds of aspects of the ecosystem that it would be really useful to be able to now cast and forecast. The example I've shown here is a project I worked on a few years ago. You might want someone a little less scary looking delivering the forecasts. This was just like something I cobbled together in Photoshop. But the project was forecasting right whales. And the reason, you might not know, right whales, the northern right whale, is only about 400 left in the world. They all come to the Gulf of Maine to feed. And there are major sources, that's actually starting to change now that they're moving up to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, getting warmer waters. But historically, they've come to the Gulf of Maine to feed. And major sources of mortality are things like ship strikes and gear entanglements. And so we thought if you can forecast where those whales are going to be, you can help reduce those sources of mortality, and it would be kind of a conservation tool. And the reason that we can make those forecasts is because we can see the ocean microbiome from outer space. And I'll connect those dots. I thought someone had their hand up. So here's the Gulf of Maine. You can see Cape Cod curled up over there in Nova Scotia. And the green that you see is a phytoplankton bloom. Those are single-celled organisms. They're green because they're plants. And we can see them from outer space. And we have satellites circling the Earth all the time, making daily and hourly measurements of essentially how green the water is. They're collecting different wavelengths of light, and you can figure out actually a lot more about not just how green it is, but some information about what species are there and that sort of thing. But you can measure, basically you can measure chlorophyll from outer space. We take that information, and so chlorophyll feeds crustaceans, which feed right whales. And so you can take all that information and put it into a mathematical model. This is where my math geek comes out again. And graphically, it might look something like this. So here's Cape Cod Bay. Those are supposed to be arrows moving back and forth here. Those are the tides. So that tells you where water is flowing. Each time it goes in and out is one tide. That image is just kind of a representation of the chlorophyll that you just saw in a less pretty version. And then these are the ones on the left are different species of crustaceans that right whales eat. And what you're watching is kind of a winter into a spring bloom unfold. And the different species sort of bloom at different times of year. We can use that information, sort of historically, as well as information on where whales have been sighted in the past, to put together whale forecasts. And this is what our whale forecasts would look like. We would have these colored areas where we thought whales were going to be, and then they would fly surveys, and the dots are where, after the fact, where the whales turn up. So it actually worked out quite well, and, it was really amazing proof of concept that you could do ecosystem forecasting like this in the ocean on, like, a daily and weekly time scale. One of the things I've been doing lately is trying to tap into social media as a source of data. So I mentioned that jellyfish sighting project. This is an image showing all tweets as the sun rises across the Americas. And you can imagine if you were a troglodyte living underground and had no idea that the Earth was turning, but you could tap into the internet somehow, you could figure out something about this geological scale process this sort of geoscale process just based on, you know, the yellow dots, the information and the internet. And the reason I'm showing you this is because there's just a slew of information out there. There are people that are out there observing the environment. And so now I'm going to jump to some of the jellyfish data in Maine and around the world. And it's not just jellyfish. This is just one of many, many examples. And we actually have a really strong tradition of citizen science in Maine, which is an amazing thing to tap into as well, of people observing their environment. And so now with this forecasting, I'm trying to figure out ways of tying this sort of data into the satellite images we're collecting to try to produce forecasts of all kinds of different species. And I think that would be a really useful adaptation tool as well. As things are changing, we can see it almost instantaneously, and we can forecast to some degree where things are going. And that information is key to being able to adapt. And the other thing that it does is, it connects. It's another way of connecting people back to the environment. It forces people to be looking and observing, and then knowing that that information is going into something that, again, something that they can see and see how their data is changing. I think it's a neat way to help people connect with the natural world. That's the last kind of... Oh, and this is just one of my jellyfish forecasts for this year. Anyway, it's low this year, by the way. We've only gotten a few sightings, and our forecast was low. Normally, yellow was the color we were seeing last year. It's not... We don't even see any of the coast yellow this year. But if you do see jellyfish, let me know. And hopefully we'll get our forecast right. So that was the last adaptation tool. There are lots of other ones, and maybe your questions will prompt me to talk about some of them. But anyway, thank you for coming. I hope you enjoyed it.
With Nick.
Yeah, I'll stick around.
That would be great.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask two questions before you leave. I want to know how you heard about this talk. Did you hear about it in the newspaper? Did you hear about it from Belfast Bay Watershed Coalition newsletter? Did you hear about it from Waterfall Arts newsletter? Any other way? From a friend?
Facebook.
Okay. That's just, I meant to do that earlier. It's just good to know. And I have one other thing I wanted to say. But I did want to say about the oxygen, the salps. I did the element oxygen, and I talked about the microorganisms in the oceans and in other waters actually produce most of our oxygen.
Yeah.
And I always thought it was trees.
Yeah.
I learned that in fourth grade. Wrong, Mrs. Schulte.
You know, it's amazing how many, this field is advancing so fast, especially with the discovery of the microbiome, the ocean and the human, that so many textbook things are being found wrong. Almost every month you hear of something that you always thought was true, and it turns out isn't.
Okay. So, if you like this talk, we didn't charge for it, but any and all donations are most welcome. We try to offer our stuff for free, but it does cost us to do things, so... Whatever you can contribute would be great. Thank you, and thanks, Nick, again, and he'll answer questions.
Yeah, I'll answer some questions.
Great.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
I hope it felt a little bit optimistic at the end.
Yeah, you're good.